DW Spectrum with Gabriel Borrood and Connor Dillon.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum. My name is Connor Dillon.
And I am Gabriel Borrood.
And Gabe is kind of half here. Actually, that's generous. You're not really fully here this week, Gabe.
Yes, I am here right now, but I'm working for the Environment Department. DW's yeah. Environment Department is putting on a podcast. On the Green Fence. We did a season last year, working on the second season right now. So I have no idea what you're doing the show about this week.
And you don't need to, because you're going to be out of here pretty quickly. You are literally straddling the fence right now. So again, yeah, Gabe has another project that began last year and is continuing into this year. And I've brought you into the studio this time because I recommend that all of our listeners give it a chance.
It's called On the Green Fence. It obviously has to do with environmental topics. Me and Neil and I, we're working together on WorldLink.
This is Neil King.
Neil King, DW employee. We had a rapport and we kind of built on that rapport. The two of us are not environment journalists. So that's an important part about it, that we went at these topics with a fresh perspective. I would even say naive, inexperienced perspective, trying to delve into this world, because this Germany is an interesting place to be when it comes to the environment. People, this population takes the environment unbelievably seriously.
When it comes to most major purchases or major financial decisions, Germans tend to consider the environmental impact as a huge part of that decision. I was talking to someone in Berlin recently, a woman who was about to buy a new, I think it was a washing machine or a dryer, and was literally only considering energy efficiency was the primary consideration. That's one tiny example. But I know you get into a lot of other things on your show, Gabe.
Yeah, we did 5 episodes last year. One of them was about the idea or the question, should we have kids? It is detrimental for the world. Human beings are detrimental for the planet. The question then, should we continue our existence on this earth if we're so bad for it? to be serious here, we talk to kids about the environment. Students at a high school, and just listen to how seriously they take the topic.
It's everywhere. The theme is everywhere. In 10 years, you can't do anything about climate change anymore. And in, I don't know, 40 years, the world will be destroyed, most of it. And yeah, so we see it everywhere.
I just generally believe that many people just think they can't really do very much about climate change. And that it's like, may have an impact upon it. If you enforce policies that would be stopped, I guess it would make a big difference, but most people just don't think they can make a difference.
I think I'm mostly worried, about the heat, because maybe sometimes if you see some figures how hot it will be in, 50 years or something, it's kind of scary. And also, about how society is going to change because of maybe refugees or something. Like, all those people from Africa maybe need to go north or something because it's too hot in Africa. I think it could really be, some dystopia,
Was this an elite school? I mean, they sound so well informed to me for kids their age.
Not at all elite. As a matter of fact, it was the closest high school to my house in a very normal part of Cologne.
That's really impressive how articulate they are in a second language about policy issues that are domestic, that are national, that are global in nature.
We didn't know them. We just we jumped in on an English class. They were working on Hamlet. We talked to the teacher and said, "Can we talk to your children, to your students?"
Incredible.
Got a question with and then they just went
and
with
very
it.
Different. They're obviously growing up with a very different perspective or outlook on the world than certainly I did growing up, and probably a lot of our listeners out there. So, Gabe, this was a clip from one of the episodes from last year, and that you're now working on new ones.
Yeah, we're doing a fresh batch. I don't want to give away too much, but we're going to look into the psychology. I mean, imagine if a 16-year-old is already thinking along those terms: dystopia, apocalypse, the world is coming to an end.
Well, I've got 10 years left, so I'm...
Imagine the collective impact on the psyche.
Yeah.
We're going to look into the psychology of climate change, what it is doing to us. That'll be at least one of the episodes, maybe even a theme for the whole season. But
we're in the
research phase and we're going at it. So I'm out of here, Connor.
Get out of my studio,
Have
Gabriel.
Have a great
Borrood.
Show.
Okay, so that is Gabe leaving the studio, and let's go ahead and take a quick break.
DW. Made for minds.
Okay, so that brings us into the real show this week, Spectrum. And I have to warn you in advance, it is not the most optimistic show that we've ever broadcast here from Deutsche Welle, from the SciTech team. But I think it covers a couple of very important topics. And the first topic that we're going to discuss is one that I hope you haven't come across in advance, because it did make headlines around the world. And it is a new study based on an unbelievable amount of data points. And this study, or this research rather, has identified the single year in which human beings are the unhappiest. Again, so this could be any age at any point in your life, but apparently there is a single year where most people are the most unhappy. And before I divulge the answer to that question, and there is a very concrete answer to that question, I went out on the streets here in Bonn, Germany, and I wanted to check in with Germans and figure out what they thought. And to do that, I figured I had to talk to the oldest people I could find, because of course they've lived a lot of their lives already, and I wanted to know what they would have to say. At what age are human beings the unhappiest?
Das hängt von der Gesundheit ab. Ich denke mir, das geht so ab Mitte 70 los.
Mitte 70, yeah. So 75.
Ab 70.
Okay, so 70 years or older.
With 14.
14 years old?
Yes.
Can I ask how old you are?
67.
Your name is?
Peter.
Peter says 14, and your name?
My name is Winfried, and I think it's about also 14 till 17.
And why did you choose that age?
It's a question of changing human life, and then you are responsible for all things what you are doing.
I think if you are over 75.
And how old are you?
77.
Oh, so you, wait, so you're in the bad zone now, is that what you're saying? You're in the unhappy time?
No, I can't say so.
I was going to say, should I ask your husband what's going on here?
Ongoing unhappy.
Ongoing unhappiness? Is that what's going on? Oh, she just slapped him on the shoulder.
But if you want to know one special year, it was the year when I was retired.
The unhappiest?
Yeah, when I finished my normal job and I was retired and had nothing to do. And that was an unhappy day.
But that's what everyone dreams about, yeah. Retirement.
In my case, it was very early, with 60.
60 years 16, old when you retired.
16, yeah. Well, that was too early.
Okay, so quite a few answers there. The majority, as you heard, seemed to be somewhere around the 70s, mid-70s. A lot of Germans talking about how your health drops off, kind of drops off a cliff sometimes at that point. And then we had those other guys that you heard from who thought, nah, it's more like 14 to 17, when suddenly you have to make big life choices. And it's all your responsibility and your fault if you make the wrong ones. Well, let's go ahead and find out what the actual answer is. And we're going to go to the researcher behind the headlines, behind the number. His name is David. David, I have you on the line now. Can you go ahead and introduce yourself to the listeners of Spectrum?
David Blanchflower, Professor of Economics at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, and currently wintering in Florida.
Ooh, not a bad place to be. So, David,
exactly.
Our listeners have just heard a bunch of German voices, elderly German voices. I went out in the city of Bonn and asked a bunch of elderly-looking people, hey, what do you think the age is that most human beings are most unhappy at? And the overwhelming majority of them said 70s and older. And that is not what you see in your data. What is the age that most human beings are the most unhappy?
The data we have around the world from 132 countries says that there's a midlife crisis. In developed countries, the low point is about 47, and in developing countries, it's 48. But the people you spoke to, of course, are older folks. And clearly there's an issue as people get older. They're a 75-year-old, an 80-year-old, an 85-year-old tends to be less healthy than, let's say, a typical 35-year-old. So there are issues past the age of 70 or so. But the data we've really been looking at is really data from 18 to around 75 or so. After 75, lots of things happen, and people obviously are closer to death at 85 than they are at 35. But this study is sort of surprising in that it's true everywhere.
Let's get into how you came to this conclusion. What data were you looking at, and how are you defining unhappiness in order to arrive at the magical or unmagical year of 47 or 48?
I'm an economist, so we've been looking, my colleagues and I, and over a number of years, have looked at people's self-reports of their happiness. So we ask people about how happy you are, how satisfied with your life are you, and we also ask them about being depressed and fed up and lonely, and essentially take the data files from around the world. So the two papers, one has 10 million people we've talked to, and the other one has 500,000 people. And so these are surveys. We analyze the surveys, and we can work out statistical evidence from those surveys. And then we validate them against what happens in the real world. And so this seems to be an appropriate way to do this. And I took all the big files that exist, and here we have the answer, 132 countries. All of them have this U-shape in happiness, or an inverted U-shape in unhappiness.
What is the reason for this? This number surprised me. It surprised a lot of people I spoke with, at least here in Germany. What's going on? Do you have any insight as to why people are most unhappy at 47? Is it menopause? Their health is declining? This empty nest syndrome? What's going on?
Obviously, this is a puzzle. I'd like to throw something in here, which is actually that maybe there's something deeply biological going on. There's a famous new study been done, recently published, shows that the same thing occurs in great apes, chimpanzees and orangutans. The keepers and volunteers are asked to tell us about the happiness of these great apes. So that's the first thing. Maybe something deeply biological is going on. I'm not a biologist. I'm an economist. But we think probably that what actually probably is happening is people get to the point in their midlife low, and they become more realistic. They say, okay, I've made those mistakes in the past. I'm not going to make them again. And they look to see what's happened to other people. And you start to realize that perhaps some of the people you went to school with have died. And then eventually, as you say, you get to the empty nest point, and then perhaps the world becomes simpler and easier. And I'm in my mid-60s, and I'm certainly on the upward slope in part of my happiness function. And I guess I'm happier than I was in the late 40s, and I had a midlife crisis then, and I don't anymore.
Were there any exceptions to this rule? It sounds like this is really quite universal, but did you see anything that indicated, well, maybe there's one way to skirt around this unhappy number?
Not really. Obviously, that we look to see, is it different between men and women? Is it different across countries, rich countries, poor countries, countries with low levels of life expectancy against high ones, poor countries against rich countries? The answer is no. So vulnerable people particularly are an issue in a world where we've had slow growth over the last decade and austerity imposed in many places, which means that there have not been resilient communities to help those people. So people, particularly in the last decade or so, vulnerable in their middle age.
Okay, so if I'm understanding you correctly, if I were a doctor or working in medicine and I knew that somebody was at risk anyway, or they were living an at-risk lifestyle, that if when they approached the age of 47 or when they were in their 40s, I should pay particular attention to their well-being?
Well, I think the answer to that has to be yes. We've seen this, as I say, America is really the centerpiece of this. And just to put this in comparable terms, last year in America, 70,000 people died from overdoses from drugs. The comparable number for Europe is about 8,500. So what's that? An eighth as much for a population about the same.
Roughly comparable, yeah.
Yeah, but still, obviously important. But these numbers are absolutely huge, and certainly, I think that this tells you that this midlife nadir is a really big problem. And what we learn how to get through this is you need people around you, family, religious organizations, friendly societies, social societies, in a sense, in the community, that will help you through. And in America, many of these places, I mean, I live in the state of New Hampshire, called the Live Free or Die State, a rich state, low unemployment rates. It ranks third in drug poisoning deaths. There's very little social backup. There's not drug rehab programs. there's not that much social support. So we have to try and understand why that's happening. And it appears that these issues are spreading around the world.
Okay, so maybe a new factor to list among the risks for our health, the age of 47 or 48 or somewhere around there. David, thank you for taking the time to talk to us on Spectrum today.
Thank you for having me.
Once I was 7 years old, Mama told me, go make yourself some friends or you'll be lonely. Once I was 7 years old. Once I was 7 years old.
Okay, so kind of from a dark point, a low point in human existence, to a topic now that I think affects more people on a day-to-day basis. And this is cynicism. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, it's kind of a darker show. We have some darker topics in here. Cynicism, I want to define it first very clearly so we all know what we're talking about here. This is the tendency to believe that people are morally bankrupt and that they behave treacherously to maximize self-interest. So basically that feeling some of you out there may have sometimes where you feel like, man, everyone else is just out to get their own and I'm the only one trying to do good here. Well, you're not alone in that feeling. And in fact, it turns out, according to new research out of the Netherlands, that this feeling may become a self-fulfilling prophecy, that once you start in on feeling cynical, you might get trapped in there. Again, it comes from the Netherlands, from the University of Tilburg, from a Russian researcher. Her name is Olga Stavrova. Now, Olga was not able to speak with me live, but I did have some questions for her, and she responded to them. And my first question for Olga was, well, how do people become cynical?
So, as with most personality traits, there is a genetic component to it. So this is like about 50%. And then there is the environment, the context, the experiences that people have. And so we looked at the experiences, and specifically we looked at negative social experiences, so the experiences of being disrespected. So what we found is that experiencing disrespect, that is being looked down on, insulted, treated as if one is not smart, so these experiences lead to more cynicism, and the more cynical people become, the more likely they are to experience disrespect again.
Okay, my next question was about disrespect. So the question was, what is an example, whether real from her research or just imagined, of someone getting trapped in a cynicism feedback loop?
For example, you are driving to the office and somebody cuts in front of you. Or you are in a meeting at work and somebody ignores your comments and acts as if you didn't exist at all. So these experiences might make you more cynical about the people who disrespected you, but also about the human nature more generally. At the same time, we have shown that people don't like cynics, so they don't like those who endorse a cynical worldview and express it, and they tend to treat those people with disrespect. So basically, the more disrespected you are, the more cynical you get. And the more cynical you get, the more likely you are to be disrespected in the future.
Okay, so this is one of those things that I intuitively feel is correct, that it seems to, I feel like I've seen this before, that there's one toxic comment, or even I've felt this before, one toxic comment, and then it comes into me, and then I kind of puke that negative feeling out on someone else, and they get infected by it, they puke it on the next person. My question for Olga, though, was, how can you measure something like that? How can you measure the development of cynicism?
We had several studies where we followed participants over time. So, for example, in one study, we followed participants over 4 years, in another study, over 7 days. So how it works. We measure participant cynicism and their experiences of disrespect via self-reports. So we ask participants questions such as, how often in the past weeks did you feel that you are treated with disrespect by others, and so on. And so we do that at one time point, and then 4 years or 7 days, depending on the study, later we do that again. We measure disrespect and cynicism again. And so we, using this method, we could show that people who were originally more cynical, they were more likely to experience disrespect in the future. And at the same time, people who were more likely to experience disrespect at baseline, they were more likely to become cynical or more cynical in the future.
Big and very important question here. How many people were involved in these studies and where were the people being studied?
So in the first study, we had about the longest study, the four-year study. So here we had about 10,000 people. In the second study, the seven-day study, we had about 500 people. So in the first study, the 10,000 people, they were elderly Americans. In the second study, they were like more representative of the American population.
Now, I would assume all of my listeners, all of the listeners of Spectrum out there in the world, you don't want to become cynical. You don't want to get trapped in this whirlpool of cynicism and get sucked down the drain. So my question for Olga was, what are your tips for people who don't want to become cynical?
In other projects, we showed that education could be an antidote to cynicism. So people who achieve high levels of education are less likely to develop cynical beliefs over time. Also, in another project, we show that health problems could contribute, could fuel cynicism development. And both education and good health could be helpful in reducing these insecurities and the dependence on others. And so they could prevent cynicism development via this mechanism. We haven't studied how to make sure that the negative experiences that we make, like the experience of disrespect, does not fuel cynicism. But I suspect that changing the way that you interpret others' behavior could be helpful.
Okay, final question for Olga Stavrova, this bonus question really asked. You know, you could have studied anything and you chose cynicism of all fields. Why?
So I watched a lot of Dr. House, the TV show, who is like a very, very nice example of a cynic.
And how often do you get an answer like that? That is why Olga Stavrova chose her field, the field of cynicism, because she watched a TV show and there was a cynic and she liked it. So Olga, thank you for that very honest answer. That is probably how a lot of us are either knowingly or unknowingly inspired through television or movies. And here she's telling us how it was for her. Again, that was Olga Stavrova. She's a cynicism researcher from the University of Tilburg in the Netherlands.
DW. Made for Minds.
And on to our final topic of this broadcast. A lot of you will not have seen this news because it wasn't even really news. It was just an event that happens regularly in Brussels, Belgium. And this happened to be the first European Space Conference of the 2020s. At least that's one way to put it. I don't know everything that happened there, but one of my DW colleagues, Daphne Altioch, was there, and I've got Daphne on the line here. Daphne, can you go ahead and tell our listeners around the world, what was this event about?
Well, yeah, so yeah, I tried to put it in that way. It was the 12th European Space Conference. And basically, it took like 2 days, and like all the people from the space industry within Europe and outside of Europe were there. That was quite interesting, actually.
And I took a look at the list of topics being discussed. Of course, the head of the European Space Agency, Jan Werner, was there. There were a lot of big names, anything from satellites to the future of rocketry, all sorts of different topics there. You went in with one clear angle, one thing that you wanted to learn there and talk more about. What was that?
Yep, it was new space. So basically, for those who don't know, new space is basically, look, we are not in the Cold War era anymore, and it's not like two countries dominating the space, but there are more and more countries involved in space industry, plus private enterprises like Elon Musk. You know, we all know Elon Musk, and he's like the superstar, he's everywhere, but it's actually very new that there are new private enterprises that are involved in space industry. So we want to see like how what the new space is, and actually can it help us to tackle some of the problems that we face here on Earth.
What was the takeaway about new space and in the coming decade?
Yeah, one of the main takeaways I had with me was that basically when I think of space, I always imagine like space travel, you know, all these characters from sci-fi movies come to my mind, like Doctor Who or Star Trek or Star Wars. But actually, like, most of the space industry is involved in satellite, not like colonizing Mars or space travel or building like spaceships where we can both, like, all of us can live happily ever after. So it was really interesting to see for me because it was very, very bureaucratic. Like, there were a lot of people wearing suits, you know, old white men walking around, greeting each other. They knew each other already. And then they were talking about space. And this is really not how I imagine people involved in space are. Like, there was no Elon Musk. There was no superstar-like figures, you know, doing karaoke about space theme songs, or like there was no smashing of cars or space cars or whatever Elon Musk was doing. So
I mean, it sounds kind of silly, but in a way you're also saying that when it comes to the European, I was going to say space race, but the European space endeavors, that there is no sexy figure. There is no marketing guru who gets everyone's attention and makes people get excited about it.
Not at all. I mean, I don't know if it's a difference between, like, the, you know, European versus American way of doing things. And if you think about it, it actually makes sense because, like, still most of the actors that are involved in space industry, they are governments, right? So they are serious people who have to run big budgets, who are getting money from taxpayers. So they don't have the luxury to do PR or, like, you know, get involved in, like, big, expensive shows.
Did you enjoy the event? It sounds kind of like you didn't.
It was interesting. Let me put it in that way. I think I enjoyed it. I mean, I've been a space nerd since I was a child, and I'm always interested in space-themed stuff. That's why we were there. But it was eye-opening in a way to know it put my feet on the ground.
I was just going to ask, you're in Brussels, known for its chocolate, its waffles, its very powerful beer, high alcohol percentage beer. Did any of that come through? Was there anything special about experiencing the space conference in Brussels as opposed to elsewhere?
Well, we didn't really have, like, Belgian beer or waffles. But though I can say that actually, like, Belgians love their butter and bread next to it. And that was there at the space conference as well. But
a big block of butter at the space
conference. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, like, there's a knife next to it. And then there was the bread basket. And before the meal, before lunch, everyone was just going to the butter and, like, putting some butter on their bread, which was interesting for me.
That cannot have been the extent of the catering at a European space conference, was it?
No.
I hope not.
Well, I think that was the most tasty part.
Okay, so not exactly a ringing endorsement of the 12th European Space Conference, the first one of this decade, but Daphne, thank you for giving all of our listeners around the world a kind of glimpse into what it's actually like going to an event like this in Brussels, Belgium.
Thank you.
Well, that brings us to the end of this week's show. Again, a special thanks to Daphne Altioch there, who was talking to us from Brussels. Also to Olga Stavrova, the cynicism researcher from the Netherlands. And to David Blanchflower, who gave us the magic number 47, or more specifically 47.2, as the unhappiest year of human existence. And also to all those Germans who took their time to talk to me on the streets of Bonn, Germany. Thanks also to my technician, Michael Springer, and to all of you for joining in this week. Again, if you have any questions, comments, thoughts, insights, I was going to say pictures you want to send me, but I'm not sure that's a good idea. Send them to spectrum@dw.com and we will reply. We also read some of those emails on the air. I wish a wonderful, healthy, happy week to all of you listening right now, and especially to the 47-year-olds.